This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. You've probably heard of microfinance. Maybe you are even a microfinancier. It's been one of the most popular and fastest growing segments of charitable giving, except it isn't giving, it's lending, usually at low or no interest, to people who live in parts of the world where a little money can go a long way. But do any of us really know what happens when you click a few buttons and your $25 goes to Morocco or Palestine or Ecuador or the Philippines? Actually, there is at least one man who does know. Bob Harris is the author of The International Bank of Bob. He's joining us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Bob, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you actually went to meet some of the people who borrowed money from you. But before you tell us about that, I want to sort of step back and to when you first became involved in this issue or this way of supporting people around the world. When did you first learn about micro lending?
Well, pardon me, a little scratchy this morning.
It's a little earlier there on the West Coast. We understand.
A tiny bit, tiny bit. I lucked into a job as a luxury travel writer for a while. I've been a writer my whole life, and that's a giant game of freelance, you bet your desk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And working 60-hour weeks so I can avoid having a regular job because I'm brilliant that way. And so I basically met the right guy in a bar, and next thing you know, I'm working for Forbes Traveler, getting paid to review billion-dollar hotels, the finest accommodations in the world. Not because I was an expert on that stuff, but mostly because I'm a working class guy who will make my deadlines, you know, get the spelling right, get the names right, and do the job properly, which is a little bit more important than, you know, when you're a writer than a lot of other considerations. So the next thing you know, I'm, you know, working class kid from Ohio. I'm from a suburb of Cleveland. I'm suddenly sashaying around the south of France and, you know, getting the fancy treatment. It's all fabulous. And that's easy to do in the south of France or in the English countryside or whatever. But in the developing world, a lot of times the richest places are right next to, you know, very poor places. And it's one thing to see it on TV and be aware of it. But when it's right there in front of you, it becomes really hard. I honestly have no idea how people can, in Dubai, for example, which is where it got to me, how you can step out of these billion-dollar hotels, and they're building the next one right next door. So the workers aren't exactly invisible. They're right there. Mm-hmm. And just sort of not look at people who are working 12-hour days in 105, 110-degree heat, and it's humid there, too. You know, in the living 10 to a room in camps out in the desert for $6 a day. How do I just take the money I'm getting paid, shove it in my pocket, walk away, and say, well, that was fun? I want to do something to try to, you know, help these people, and they wouldn't have been stuck in this situation if the economies in the countries they came from, you know, parts of India, Kerala, Sri Lanka, East Africa, Southeast Asia, if the villages they came from, if the economies there were such that they were able to make more than a couple of bucks a day, or if they could, they probably wouldn't have had to come and take a job like this just so they could send a of that $6 a day, they send a couple dollars of it a day home to take care of their family.
Hmm. But of course, you had money. You could easily have given that money away. Why did you become involved in microfinance or microlending as a way to address this problem?
Well, you know, I considered that. I really didn't know what to do with it. I mean, okay, here I am. I've got a little nest egg from the travel. I decided I would take my travel money, and that would be what I would spend. So it's like $20,000, and I'm fortunate enough that I could put it into something. But what do I do? Yeah, I mean, do I just hand it to the Red Cross and kind of hope? You know, I wanted some sort of transparency. I wanted to see exactly where it went. And I didn't just want to do, I mean, a lot of charity is about, and it's desperately necessary. I'm not criticizing this, but you know, a lot of it is, you know, there's been an earthquake here, there's been a tragedy here, and let's handle that. But rarely is it about, you know, trying to structurally, you know, change lives, change an economy, build a base in places. And that seemed to me like something long term that might be worthwhile. So I wanted transparency. I wanted to, you know, to be helping something grow. And I really looked around a lot. And at that time, the pioneers of microfinance in Bangladesh, the Grameen Bank and Muhammad Yunus, had shared the Nobel Peace Prize recently, and that sort of got my attention. And this charity, Kiva, kiva.org in San Francisco, which is the main lending platform that people use, and I encourage people to visit the thing and check it out. It's a little bit like eBay for doing good. You just scroll through, and instead of things that people are selling, you know, here's a woodworker in Nepal, and here's a bicycle delivery guy in Nicaragua, and a fisherman in Bangladesh. And here's what they need the money for. Here's how they're going to use it. And it's all very directly laid out. And that was really appealing. It was, wow, I could, you know, these people, and they actually need the funds. And there's specific things they're going to do with it. And I thought, well, look, that's interesting. And in all candor, since it was a loan, I also thought, and if this doesn't work, well, I'll get the money back and then I can give it to the Red Cross.
Mm-hmm. Now, and we should mention, by the way, your book is promoted on the Kiva website. So there's a partnership there, right?
It was never set up that way. What happened was, I mean, I approached them. They had no idea what to make of me. And it's common for their lenders to want to go visit clients in the field, which is not a practical thing to do, I would tell you. Having done it now, it's not easy to just show up in Rwanda and say, okay, I'm looking for Josephine.
Well, that's a lot of $25 loans that you are spending instead to get to Rwanda, right?
Right. There's that too. Yeah. So I talked to a publisher in New York who really liked the idea of the project. He gave me an advance that covered a lot of the travel, and you know, I was able to get that done. And Kiva was originally a little reluctant. They had no idea what to make of me. And gradually over time, mutual respect started to evolve. And as I'm very frank about in the book, I gradually got to know them and see how they work and see how the whole thing, it actually does work really well. And, you know, it's so easy to be skeptical these days. We're trained to be skeptical about everything. And so a lot of respect evolved. And so when the book came out, I don't hesitate to talk about shortcomings and failures and where things have screwed up. That's actually all in the book. But transparency is really, you know, one of their very highest values. So since I did a really full, honest accounting of it, they thought, yeah, this is pretty cool. And they went ahead and they mentioned on the website, yeah.
We're talking to Bob Harris. In addition to writing the International Bank of Bob about his experience doing some micro-lending and meeting the people to whom the money is sent, he's also speaking here in Kansas City on Thursday night at 5:30 at Avila University. Registration is required. We'll have more info on that at kcur.org. Give us a little primer on microfinancing, Bob. How does it work?
Well, it's just so the people, and if anybody's not familiar with it, it's really just bringing the same financial tools that we take for granted, primarily credit, but also savings, and in some cases even insurance, to the working poor. Mm-hmm. If a fisherman in Bangladesh has a hole in his rowboat, you know, there's a thing about, you know, if you give a person a fish, they eat for a day, you teach them to fish, they eat for a lifetime. What if they already know how to fish, but the guy just has a hole in his rowboat? He needs to repair it, and he's got a functional business, but he can't walk into a loan at Citibank and say, hey, I need a bridge loan. They're not going to serve him. There's hundreds of millions of unbanked people around the world who are actually far more sophisticated about their finances and how to handle things than I think maybe we in the developed in the first world, as people call it, might appreciate. But you know what? It turns out when you live on like $3 a day, you keep really close track of your money. I mean, mm-hmm. way more than we do. And if you visit, you know, the slums of Nairobi or wherever, actually, there are things resembling the financial instruments that you and I use. We have cash and we have checking and we have credit. There's actually analogs to that. There's not really time to get into it in remarkable places. So these people are actually pretty sophisticated, but they just need the funds. So microlending is essentially making the funds available. There are microfinance institutions, essentially lending banks, set up, and they range in size from little mom-and-pop things to big, actually international concerns. Even a couple have gone IPO, which I'm not a fan of that.
Of it because those are for-profit rather than non-profit organizations.
Come on, if we're trying to help people who are making, $1 or $2 a day or $3 a day or whatever, you know, in India, there was a lender a few years ago that actually went IPO. And you know what? I don't care if you're, you know, the CEO of a giant organization. You know, if you're making millions of dollars helping, and I'm doing air quotes on the radio here, people who are making $1.50 a day, that doesn't pass the smell test for me, frankly. And There are shortcomings in the field. There are a lot of people who do it, and everybody that Kiva partners with, by the way, they do some serious due diligence before they partner with anybody. They have partners in 76 countries now, I think, something like that.
Really
check them out.
Where are, I mean, we'll talk more about some of the details of what happens with that $25 or whatever, but let's talk about those countries. You say there are 76 countries where they have these partnerships. Where in the world is this the biggest? Where is microlending really having a profound impact right now?
The most, I guess, you developed of the developing countries that where they use microfinance frequently. You can't drive down the road in Peru without seeing big ads on the side of the road, big wooden billboards for microfinanzas of some local organization everywhere. Cambodia, it's all over the country. The Philippines, there's a number of countries. They tend to be the countries that basically did it the longest, where somebody set it up. By far the most, I would say, would be Bangladesh, where the Grameen Bank is from, and where Grameen has, which is Bengali for a village, so it's like the village bank. They've expanded out into all sorts of other social business. Muhammad Yunus has pushed for everything from, they did a partnership with Danone where they were able to bring vitamin-enriched yogurt very affordably to villages all over Bangladesh. They've gotten into health. They've gotten into mobile communications. They've gotten into all sorts of different things, all of it being working to try to make sure that everybody at the bottom are the ones who are really profiting, figuring that if everybody at the bottom is profiting, then the folks at the top will do okay. And it's remarkable what's happened in Bangladesh.
Wow. Let's invite our listeners to share some of their experiences or also their questions. If you have been involved in microlending yourself, if you've made loans and had an experience seeing them paid back or not, give us a call, 816-235-2888. Do you think this is the way of the future in terms of international development? 816-235-2888 is the number. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So let's say there is a young man in Bangladesh or a young woman who wants to open a shop in Ecuador. What do they do? How are borrowers assessed, and who's actually making this loan?
Well, there are local institutions that they can go to in their neighborhoods, their villages, their cities. Every organization, just like different banks here, they have their own process. They vet the clients. Now, sometimes it's individuals, sometimes there's group loans. Microfinance really began primarily in forms of group loans, where when people had essentially nothing but the social capital of vouching for each other in groups. It was pioneered in Bolivia and Brazil. You'd go into a village and everybody would go in together on a loan. But it's done differently in different places. There's not one fixed formula. But they go to the local people. Those folks, by their own criteria, decide whether to make the loan. And then of the thousands of microfinance institutions in the world, Kiva works with 160, something like that, that they've been able to vet and do due diligence with. And so when you as a listener decide that you get interested in Kiva, you decide that you want to put $25 into the fisherman in Bangladesh's business or whatever, you go to the website, your funds are tracked. They go to back the loan in Bangladesh as the guy repays or the woman repays. Penny by penny, it's accounted for and ultimately returned to you with a repayment rate of something around 99%. My own personal repayment rate's been 99.5 roughly. So that's pretty remarkable.
And they're being loaned at 0% interest, right?
Actually, no. You don't get any interest as a Kiva lender. You're not making any money on it. The local partner, in order to stay in business, they do tend to charge an interest rate that is low by local standards, and sometimes looks quite low to our eyes as well. Sometimes due to local inflation rates, the cost of doing business in rural areas or so on, the interest rate can actually look a little bit high to our eyes. But compared to the options that are available on the black market, where interest rates are often in the high three digits, then it's actually pretty reasonable, and people do sign up for it.
When you say reasonable, what percent are we talking about?
As I said, it varies. In India, for example, there's a organization called Rangda that makes education loans at 9%, which sounds high, except the inflation rate in India is 7.5%. So they're making a percent and a half or something like that on an education loan that's not going to get repaid for years. So that's a great deal. Most of the Kiva partners, it varies wildly. It can be in the 10-15% in a country with a very high inflation rate, where maybe the currency is not fantastically stable, and where somebody's doing a tremendous amount of very – it's expensive to have people traipsing from village to village and getting out to, hopping on the motorcycle and driving out into the village. The interest rates can be something like 30%, maybe even a little higher. which can look really expensive to our eyes. And I totally get that. But if you're in the field and you actually see it, there's a reason that people sign up for this by the boatload. It's because it's the best deal that they can get.
Now, in the U.S. or in a developed country, when someone can't repay a loan, there are consequences. Maybe there's a lien placed on some property. Maybe there was some collateral they put up for the loan. What happens when someone in one of these developing countries can't repay even the fairly small loan they receive?
Again, that varies a great deal locally. Clearly, they're not going to be getting another loan from that particular bank, and that's not a great thing because they want, you know, to keep their businesses going. In some cases, there actually is something resembling the repo process here. When the thing that's being financed is an asset, for example, in Kenya, one of the best models I saw, this was really cool and it really worked and it was really creating wealth, is financing a cow, a dairy cow. People, if you've got two goats and you want to build a little bit of wealth, it's actually a big deal to finance a Guernsey. African species of cows don't produce a great deal of milk. They're built for the desert. You bring in a European hybrid cow, you bring in a Guernsey, you bring in something like that, that produces a great deal more milk. You're able to sell the milk. You get two milkings a day, roughly. One of them pays off the loan. The other one is used, you know, for profit. At the end of the year, you own the cow free and clear, and now you're making money. And so people finance one cow, then they get a second cow, then they get the shelter, then they, you know, whatever. And it's remarkable. I met a bunch of people who were showing off their cows the way that you and I would show off a Ferrari.
Huh.
And it really works really well. That's a great growing system. Asset financing is a really good idea, and it works great there. But, I mean, if somebody winds up not paying off the loan, the cow can be repossessed. And that does happen sometimes.
Although I guess one would have to say that cow is probably then going to end up somewhere else in the community. So in terms of the impact on the community, it's still positive.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And like I said, that's a model that worked remarkably well. I met people who and there's photographs in the book of people showing off their cow and how that whole system works. I met people all over Kenya who but it makes total sense, too. I mean, you know, if you're a taxi driver, your taxi is your source of income. In to a dairy farmer in Kenya, that's capital equipment. The cow is capital equipment, and you'd finance it just the way you would any equipment here.
It's 816-235-2888 is the number to call to talk with Bob Harris about micro-lending. Anne at Avila University is on the line to tell us a little bit about what they're doing at Avila. Anne, good morning.
Well, good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. It's great to be talking with you all.
I'm so glad you could call in. What's going on at Avila with micro-lending?
Well, we're excited to have Bob, of course, on Thursday at 5:30. And what happened was our Common Reader program, which is where our first-year students, a book is selected. And the book that was selected over the summer was The International Bank of Bob. So our first-year students have all read The Bank of Bob and have already completed and turned in their first reflection paper. This gets a little more interesting because they are raising funds to make microloans. And after Bob comes and speaks on Thursday at 5:30, the students will then do their research on where they want their microloans to go. So our first-year students will actually be making microloans. And it kind of fits into Avila's mission, which, of course, is helping to grow and to better the global community.
And, Anne, I just want to—you mentioned the 5:30 event on Thursday. I want to clarify, that is open to the public, right?
You know, it is indeed, and it is complimentary. We've got some great sponsors. The Bank of Blue Valley is our presenting sponsor, and Rainy Day Books and KC Studio. But absolutely, the public is welcome. The key thing that they have to do, though, is go ahead to our website and register. And that's avila.edu/Truman. This is part of our Truman Lecture Series that we hold annually. So again, it's www.avila.edu.
And we'll,
/Truman. Yes.
Great. And we'll put links up to on our website as well, KCUR.org.
Yeah.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for sharing the experience that that Avila students are having with Bob's book and with microfinance. Appreciate your calling in today.
Thank you. You bet.
Bye-bye. That's Anne O'Meara, by the way, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at Avila University. Bob, are you getting a positive response from students, from sort of this rising generation? Is this sort of a core group of supporters for the whole micro-lending movement?
Yeah, very much so. I think there's a whole generation of people now who, being raised with Facebook, Twitter, and so on, it's part of the DNA, I think, if you're in your 20s, to see the world as deeply connected in a way. I'm turning 50 in a couple of weeks. You know, when I was in college to try to learn something about China, I would have to go to a library and get some translate, which would be almost impossible. And to kids today, they just, you know, well, let me ask my friend in China. And they, you know, get on the Facebook or get on the Facebook there. How 50 did I just sound?
Well, we're going to let that slide.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, the internets will, yes, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, the tubes. Let me tell you, by the way, one of the things that the book ultimately winds up becoming about, even more than microfinance, is just what the experience was as an American just walking into... Hi, I'm in Beirut. How's this going to go?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, talk a little bit about that. I, for one thing, I have to think people were awfully surprised to see you show up.
That was a common response. There would be a sort of slightly tilted head. What are you doing here? I never once, and by the way, I never told a client that I was a lender. That's a cardinal rule for me because that's gross. You know, I don't want to show up and you know, hey, I hope you like the refrigerator. You know, that would be a shame something happened to it. You know, I would just be like, that's so gross. You know, so I would just show up as an American who was interested in their lives. And they'd kind of tilt their head a little bit and, well, come on in. And next thing you know, I'm playing with the kids. And it was an amazing experience. And so
what's the most memorable one of them? Which one really stands out to you when you close your eyes and think about that experience?
You know, there's a ton, but top of my head, there was a woman I met in Rwanda that I mentioned earlier. This is a country that's recovering from, you know, one of the worst genocides, one of the worst periods in human history in 1994. And this was a single mom with three kids. Her husband was gone and she's trying to build a life. And they had been about 18 months before my visit, had been living in a shack, basically a pile of sticks, practically, with a mat on the floor. And not a good life for the kids. And the mom didn't have a lot of skills or whatever, but she learned to be able to buy produce and staples, you know, rice and cassava and potatoes and whatnot in bulk, transport them from the market and sell them in smaller quantities in her neighborhood at actually a fairly steep markup, essentially the 7-Eleven business model. You know, get a bunch of this stuff, sell it locally, and you're selling convenience to people. That's what they are. They're convenience stores. That's what you sell. And over the course of about 18 months, she'd been able to get a completely new life. They'd moved to a better part of the neighborhood in Kigali. They had a nice, small, I mean, obviously very modest, but they had a nice two-room home with the business in the front and a nice, good bed for the kids to sleep on in the back. And she was making enough money that the kids had a much nicer future. They're about to start school, and they're learning. They're going to have a fundamentally different life. And by the way, her business was financed. Her first loan was, and I'm really not kidding, the equivalent of $140 American.
Right.
Which a lot of people...
Goes a lot further
that,
there.
People drop that in Starbucks over the course of a month, you know? Yeah, I mean, that's...
Convicted, yes.
But
that goes a lot further there, obviously. $140 loan, you wouldn't even bother going to the bank for here.
Yeah. I mean, that's the difference. That's the role microfinance plays. It's not a panacea. It doesn't solve everything. It's not appropriate in every circumstance. You know, when there's been, you know, war and chaos or something, I mean, you need a certain degree of stability for it to happen. There are people who have advocated in the past who I think maybe have oversold it or something like that. But it is in the giant toolbox of development, you know, as we're trying to help the world. It's a really important tool.
Well, let's take some calls from listeners. 816-235-2888. Sonia in Spring Hill, Kansas. Good morning, Sonia.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. My family and I are longtime Kiva supporters. We started sending some money, making loans about 2006 or 2007. And I love Kiva so much. And I just wanted to throw out the idea for other listeners. We started our son making loans when he was about 4 or 5 years old. And I've also used Kiva when I've taught Bible school or Sunday school we'll have the kids collect money and then choose the loan to make, and then watch the loans, you know, as they're repaying it and all of that. But I think it's an absolutely wonderful opportunity for kids to learn about global finance, microfinance, how wealthy comparatively we are in this country, and ways to help other people.
Sonia, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. I just want to jump in. I unfortunately have never had kids, but if I were lucky enough to have them, one of the things that I would see the Kiva website, kiva.org, as being really cool is all of the entries are like little windows into lives that are both fundamentally different from our own and a lot of the external stuff. But when you get right down to it, it's also people all over the world who are exactly like us, and this comes out in the book. I mean, you get past language and religion and a bunch of other stuff. Everybody's just trying to make a better life for their kids. And when you start seeing people on that level, and this happened to me everywhere I went, I would sit with people who I thought when I first got there, well, this, I wonder how this is going to go. This is going to be different. And, you know, 20 minutes later, we're sitting around having tea. The kids crawling between my legs and we're giggling. And wow, okay, this is all the same. And so all these cultural differences and stuff, they start feeling like a little thin coat of paint that you can scratch off with your fingernail.
Yeah, sometimes you do charity work or you do good work to have an impact on someone else. Sometimes it has an impact on you.
Yeah, that comes out in the book, but it's ultimately not about me, so I don't want to get in that too much.
Clay in Kansas City, Missouri, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. I had a quick question. I was interested, and I understand completely about the global network and the need for low interest and micro loans, but I was also interested in the United States, and specifically, I could give an example like here in Kansas City, and I was wondering if there would be micro loans, low interest loans for people of low economic status that are interested in creating a business, but they don't have the equity, and they do not. And banks or institutions will not, of course, lend to them, but they have the skills to create a business. And there's specific areas. I'm a volunteer with some neighborhood groups, community organizations, and I've met people, you know, in areas of town that are of that status, and met people, and they're great neighborhood areas, but there's no markets, there's no
sure.
Corner stores, and there's a problem with access to healthy foods, as an example.
Okay, Clay, let me invite our guest, Bob, to talk a little bit about that. Appreciate the call. Bob, is there a movement at all to do microlending in the U.S. in low-income areas?
Absolutely. Thanks for the call. It's a great question, Clay. Yeah. In fact, if you go to the Kiva website and you look at the countries served, there's the United States is one of them. You can poke around on the site, do a little search, just use the words United States, and you'll find that Kiva has partnerships now with lenders all over the country, and they've made special focus in a number of cities that particularly need it, New Orleans, Detroit, Oakland. I think they recently made Little Rock a focus. Partnering with not just in Los Angeles, for example, where I am, they've partnered not just with a couple of lenders, but they also got involved with the local equivalent of a small business association, trying to get government involvement and try to form as much of a public private partnership as possible to try to stimulate the economy in a lot of areas that really are, as the word is, unbanked, and also like what Clay was saying, food deserts that are in parts of our country. We have large parts of America that have just, it's being almost 50 now, I remember being able to go to Detroit and saying, hey, neat. I mean, it's hard to imagine this now, but in 1960, Detroit was the wealthiest city in America. You know, the auto industry was still booming. That's what we've managed to do to our own country in the last 53 years.
Well, Bob Harris, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us about microlending. Bob is the author of The International Bank of Bob. He's speaking on Thursday at Avila University at 5:30. We'll have information at kcur.org. Bob, thanks again for being here.
Oh, real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can find more information also about the Midtown Community School Initiative, which we talked about in the first half of our show. We'll have links to their Facebook page and other information at kcur.org. You can also go there to subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows. Go to the Central Standard page. Join us tomorrow as we examine the Chiefs' prospects for the season, as well as talk about the Westport Middle School repurposing and other repurposings in the Kansas City School District. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, where the Book Doctors will be there. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Sydney Llewellyn and Ross Steinmetz. I'm Brian Ellison. This is KCUR.